Okay, so today I'm going to talk to you about something called quantum Shannon theory. So this is an outgrowth from a theory that was put forth in the late 40s about classical communication and say its application to problems in quantum coding theory and quantum information transmission. So basically this all started with a paper by Claude Shannon in 1948, called A Mathematical Theory of Communication. So in this paper, Shannon really outlines what the fundamental problem of communication is, and that is to transmit information-bearing sources over information-bearing channels. So I mean, this sounds obvious, but you can ask the question, well, what does he really mean by this? So what is information, what is a source, and what is a channel? Specifically, is there a way that we can somehow model these guys mathematically so that we can come up with let's say an interesting mathematical theory that has practical implications, but that yet still has some fundamental theorems that we can prove that are relevant to the real world. So one question to ask is, well, how would I model the underlying physics of a noisy process from which I'd want to protect information? And this underlying physics could be really complicated, right? So Shannon's idea was to say, let's ignore the underlying physics and let's just treat it probabilistically. So assuming that we're at least talking about classical physics here, a probabilistic model is perhaps a reasonable thing to do. And second of all, we could ask, well, what's the meaning of the message? Well, Shannon said, well, let's ignore the meaning of the message, and let's just assume that the message is just something taken from a set of possible messages. So, for instance, maybe it's a bit string of length n. So there's 2 to the n possible messages, let's say. And this brings us to the other big idea of Shannon, which was to say, let's imagine really long messages, and that we're going to try to transmit these messages by sending many different signals. So maybe we have a very long block length code. And while that seems like it might make the problem harder, it turns out that in some cases it can actually make it easier. So Shannon's two big ideas. One, long block length for codes. Two, probabilistic models. And the third big idea is to allow vanishing error. But specifically, not requiring that the error equals zero, but just that it go to zero as the length of the message becomes long. And under just these three assumptions, you can actually, what I'll try to get across to you, at least in the first part of this talk, is that there's a very nice classical theory here, which is essentially completely solved. At least for the case of point-to-point communication over classical channels. And so after I review a good part of the classical work, what I'll then go on to talk about is the first type of generalization you might hope to do to the quantum domain, where instead of having classical communication channels, maybe I have a channel where I can input classical data, but out on the output come quantum states. And then there the idea is to try to communicate classical messages over some quantum media, like a fiber optic cable or something like that. Then what I will then talk about is the quantum capacity of a quantum channel. So this is really a different type of information transmission, where instead of asking to send a classical message, you basically want to send a superposition of classical messages. And what I'll try to get across is that while the classical capacity gives you some sort of an upper bound on the amount of data that you might hope to protect from certain type of noise using error correcting codes, and it turns out it's also achievable, that the quantum capacity gives you a similar type of bound on the ability to protect quantum information using quantum error correcting codes of the type, say, that you heard about yesterday morning or afternoon from Daniel. So in particular, I'm going to talk a lot about different properties of the quantum capacity. And I'll tell you about some types of channels where we actually know how to compute it, but I'll warn you that in general, we do not know how to compute the quantum capacity, nor do we know how to compute the classical capacity of a quantum channel in general, as was indicated in Matt's talk, or for reasons given by Matt's counterexample that he talked about the other afternoon. And I'll try to give lots of examples as I go along, but one idea that I want to try to get across is that in order to even be able to talk about quantum capacity, I need to convince you that it's reasonable to talk about the idea of approximate quantum error correction. So it's somewhat of a different paradigm than the type that Daniel talked about before, but it is related in certain ways. And in particular, I want to talk about different types of distance measures that you can apply to sets of quantum states, and how they're related and how they can be used to give a consistent definition of approximate error correction, because we want to know how to say that the error goes to zero. So there needs to be some way to quantify the error. And I'll give sort of a brief outline of how you can actually prove that there exist codes achieving a quantity called the coherent information over a channel, which is sort of an analog of a mutual information that appears in Shannon's formula for the classical capacity. And then I'll close with some, close the 2 hours with some words about what we call the operational non-additivity of the quantum capacity. So the quantum capacity has some behavior that we've really never seen before in a capacity. This was only recently discovered in the past year by a collaborator and myself. But let's get started. So let me just mention some background information. So there's a book by Cover and Thomas, Elements of Information Theory. It's in some sense the standard reference for classical information theory. There's also Nielsen and Chung, which is some of the standard references on quantum information theory. And in particular, on the quantum coding theorem later, there's a paper by Devatak, 03, about the private classical and quantum capacities of a quantum channel. And also a paper by Horodetsky, Hayden, Winter, and myself in Open Systems and Information Dynamics. I won't write that down, but maybe I'll mention that later. So Shannon's idea, or one of his ideas, was to model a noisy channel as a probability transition matrix, say P of Y given X. And the idea is that you have Alice at some point, someplace in space-time, and Bob over here, and we sort of personify, or I will personify, the sender and receiver like this. So you could imagine that it's some computer memory, right, that could be faulty, and maybe the memory can take, value X in some set X, some finite set, and with probability P of Y given X, that value might get corrupted to some other value Y in some set Y. So throughout these lectures, I'm going to use capital letters like X, Y to represent random variables, and lowercase to be just, an element of a set, a concrete element in a set. So the idea is that this guy here is distributed according to these conditional probabilities if I put in, this symbol X, okay? So maybe instead of a memory, maybe this is some communication channel. And so as I said before, so Shannon was interested in the case where the error goes to zero as the number of transmissions gets large. So really, the idea is going to be this. X and Y are not, these are not messages, right? These are just symbols that Alice is going to send in order to try to relay some message to Bob. So really what we're going to imagine is they have, say, exponentially many messages. There's some message set M, which is, say, some set size 2 to the NR, where R is going to be the rate of a code. And then, so I'll just write that as the message in 2VNR. And then she's going to use some encoding function to map this into some sequence of length n. So this is the xn of m. And so the idea here is that I'll write xn to mean the sequence x1. Xn, X super n as a sequence like that. It's just some notation. And so the idea is that each one of these symbols goes through and comes out into some decoding function on Bob's side. And so Bob gets some sequence y super n of m. And again, this here is a sequence of random variables now. Right? And maybe let me just make one thing clear, that in that the most solvable cases that we tend to come across in Shannon theory are the cases where the noise acts independently on the input signal. So you can imagine if it's over some communication channel, you just send a signal and you wait long enough so that there's no crosstalk or anything like that. And this will pretty much be the paradigm that I'll use throughout the entire lecture. So here, you know, Alice put in some deterministic set of symbols, and then Bob gets out some random set of symbols. Then what he's going to do is he's going to apply some decoding function that's going to give him his best guess of the message. So just to summarize, what I've defined here is a rate R block length n code And we can ask what kind of errors does this code make? Is there a way that we can quantify that? So the simplest way would be the maximal error, right? We'll say that this is a Rn epsilon code if the probability that m hat little m does not equal little m is less than epsilon for all messages that I could send. So I'll call this a constraint on the maximal error. Right? So this says that no matter what message I make, I have some guarantee that Bob is going to recover my message with probability, or is going to make an error with error at most, with probability at most epsilon. So for a given choice of parameters, there may or may not exist a code for a given channel that has these parameters. So one of the big questions in information theory is when do there exist such codes and when don't there? So let me also add that this is sort of a very paranoid view. I could be a little more laid back about this, and I could say, well, you know, let me call this PM, probability of error with message M. I could also look at the average error, right? So I could take the sum over m to the minus nr of pm, and I could require that be less than epsilon 2. And I'll comment a little bit about this in a minute. But so we make a definition. I'll say that for this channel, I'll say a rate r is achievable if there's a sequence of codes of rate r and block length n, indexed by n, such that the error goes to zero. And if there's not such a sequence of codes, then the rate r is not achievable. So given this definition, I'll just write this up here. I can define the capacity of the channel as the supremum of the set of achievable rates. So we call this an operational definition of the capacity. So in other words, this capacity is a function on channels, right? To every probability transition matrix P of Y given X, this associates a number, a positive number or a non-negative number, and it does it in sort of an abstract way. But, you know, Shannon didn't just define a capacity. What he did was he showed that you could compute this with a nice formula. And let me tell you what this formula is. So he showed that C equals the max over input probability distributions to the channel of a quantity called the mutual information between the input and the output. So what does this mean? So given a distribution P of X, and given this conditional distribution here, these combine together to give me a joint distribution, P of X, Y. So this quantity here is a functional of this distribution, and it's defined as follows. So it's, you can write it in a couple different ways. One way is it's entropy of X plus the entropy of y minus the entropy of the pair xy. And let me just, to clarify, some people put a comma here. I'm going to leave that out. I never mean multiplication because these are just elements in a set, right? You can't even define a multiplication in general unless they're in some sort of a ring. But so this here is just to clarify, this is sum over x, p of x, log P of X minus. So it's the expected logarithm, or expected minus logarithm of the probability. So one way to view the mutual information, or to remember the formula, is to picture a Venn diagram like this. Okay. So then, let's call this guy here, this is all of H of X, and this guy here, H of Y, it's somehow the stuff in the middle, the intersection of these two. It's sort of an abstract way to characterize what this is. And similarly, I can define conditional entropy. I can say that, say, H of Y given X is just equal to, say, H of XY minus H of X, right? So the idea is that this whole diagram here is H of X, Y, this is H of X, so in here is H of Y given X. And the somewhat remarkable thing about this is that I could define this way, but it turns out that this is the same thing as the average of the entropy of Y conditioned on the value of X. So for each X, I get some distribution, P of Y given X. I compute that entropy, I average that over P of X. Yes? So this is the same thing as this, except with P of X, Y everywhere instead of P of X.
So problems are going to be occurring at the same time?
It's the joint probability, yeah. Okay. So let me just give an example. Maybe the simplest example that you could give is something called the binary symmetric channel. Here's where I put in a 0 or a 1, or Alice puts in a 0 or a 1. With probability 1 minus P, Bob gets a 0 or a 1. So he gets Alice's bit without error. But with probability P, the bit gets flipped. Okay? So it turns out that in this case, it's easy to compute this maximization. You just maximize over input bits, and it turns out that the uniform bit maximizes this guy. So you get that C equals 1 minus the binary entropy of P. So I'm going to abuse a little notation, and I'll write H of P. For what I really mean by H of the distribution P1 minus P, or the entropy of a Bernoulli P random variable. And just to plot this, it's going to look something like this. It's going to go at 1 half, here's 1, here's 0, and this is P. Let's say this is 1. It goes down, and it comes back up. And actually, the slope is infinite right here. And as you might expect, when the bit flip probability is a half, well, then the thing that comes out is always completely uncorrelated from the input. So you can never get any sort of information through. And maybe just to clarify, all logarithms are to base 2 that I'm going to be talking about. So, yeah, maybe one more example would be the P erasure channel, 0, 1, and with probability P, there's an erasure. So this is now a channel from, say, 2 symbols to 3, and here the capacity, you can show it's equal to 1 minus the error probability P. So Matt mentioned this channel in his talk, and the surprising thing is that you could do just as well as if you knew where the erasures were going to end up, but somehow you can do something clever, and at least in principle, and achieve that same rate. So what's the clever thing that you do? I haven't really told you how you go about proving this theorem. So I want to say a bit about the anatomy of a coding theorem. So first of all, maybe it's good if I take it aside and talk about an even simpler type of coding problem. And this would be the case where this channel is noiseless, okay? And then imagine that my message maybe has a little bit of structure. So let's imagine that the message is some sequence xn that's iid drawn according to probability p of x. So one of the things that's kind of the bread and butter of information theory is the fact that with high probability, this sequence is going to fall into a set of typical sequences. And this fact is something that's kind of known by the name method of types, but that's a misleading name. What it really says is that almost all sequences are almost all equally likely. And in particular, what you can show is that, you know, with probability going to 1, this set Xn is going to be in some set of typical sequences, where this set here is of size 2 to the n entropy of x, the first order in the exponent. So what we're going to see is that this is a similar idea to this. I can at least try to give you an intuitive reason for why this capacity theorem holds. So the idea is as follows. So when you want to prove this theorem, there's two parts. You want to show that for any rate less than the capacity, that there exists good codes, at least in principle. Maybe they're hard to do efficiently or in practice, but nonetheless, you want them to at least exist. Second of all, you want to show that if the rate's greater than the capacity, then basically the error has to go to something other than 0, generally to 1. So, roughly what's going to happen is this, is that if I imagine putting an input into the channel, there's going to be essentially 2 to the n h of y given x cause or results of that message. So if I put in x here, there's going to be roughly, again, the first order in the exponent, this many different possible received sequences. And so the idea is that if I pick my code words randomly, what you can show is that, for all intents and purposes, I get non-overlapping sets of sequences at the receiver, all of this size. So how many different messages can I pick so that I basically fill up the whole outside? Well, if I pick these sequences, say IID, according to this distribution here, P of X, let's say, you know, any P of X that I might use in defining this maximum here, I'm going to maximize over P of X, but just pick any one. Then, let's say that I pick less than the mutual information, right? So if I've got 2 to the n I of X, Y, if I multiply these guys together, this is 2 to the n H of Y. Right, so as long as I don't exceed this, I'm going to hit just as many sequences as I need to on the output. And so that's sort of a rough idea of how it works. And the idea is that what you do is you prove that this works if you randomly select a code book. And what that means then is that if I can get a low error on average over all selections of code books, that I can, this shows that there must exist some code that does just as well. So on the other side of the coin, so what you wind up showing by this is that the capacity is at least max over P of X of I X Y. And so let me call this quantity here C one. Now why am I going to call it that? Well, let's say that I did this over two uses of the channel instead, right? This is the exact same procedure that I just talked about. Then what I would get is that this is greater than or equal to, say, 1/2 max over P X1 X2 I X1 X2 Y1 Y2. I'll call this C2. Okay? And I could keep going forever, right? I could get essentially that the capacity is less than, greater than or equal to some limit, 1 over k, max pxk, ck. And so luckily Shannon didn't just leave us with this type of a formula. The sad state of affairs in quantum information theory is that many times this is the best type of formula that we have. But, so it's possible to show actually that you have this type of a upper bound at least. I won't get into the details of that, but it's not particularly hard. So then the question is, can I identify this limit? And it turns out that you can. If this optimization problem here is additive in the following sense. So let me define this. Let's look at this as a function on channels, right? So let's say I've got C of P cross Q. Okay, so I've got here, this is like P of X1 or Y1 given X1, and this is Q Y2 given X2. And let's even assume that, you know, these come from different sets. So X1 and X2, they might just be completely different types of signals. So if you can show that something in this form holds, that C1 of, say that this is less than or equal to C1P plus C2Q, then you're done. Right? Because you can just use recursion and break this down to essentially showing that this maximum is achieved on a product input, is what this says. Because it's not hard to show that if I pick a product distribution here, that I get this guy here, so you actually have this direction. And you want to show that it's achieved for a product. And I don't want to get into it, but it's not too hard to show for the mutual information in the classical case that that holds. And that's the main reason why Shannon's formula works, why we have an effectively computable, or not even effectively, it's generally efficiently computable formula for the capacity of a channel. It winds out actually that this is even a convex optimization problem. Right? So as a function of P of X, fixing the channel, that this mutual information is convex. So now I want to move on to talking about a certain kind of quantum mechanical channel. And this I'll call this a CQ channel for classical quantum. And the idea is that what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these probability transition matrices and I'm going to turn them into what I'll call a conditional density matrix. So the idea is that this is a channel specified by some collection of density matrices on some Hilbert space B. So throughout these lectures, when I used to use symbols like A, B, C, I'm going to mean these to be Hilbert spaces that correspond to quantum systems used by participants in this communication game. And here, Bob will be the receiver. Right? So the idea is that Alice sends a signal X, which maybe is sending a horizontal or vertically polarized photon, and rho B is the corresponding photon state that Bob sees in his lab. So you can go through all this same game here, and pretty much everything applies. The exception of when you... The first non-trivial thing that happens, well, one, I should say there's some technical hurdles towards proving that there exists good codes, because the idea is that Bob has to do a measurement now, right? So the idea is that when he's got this rho, well, I'll call it rho xnbn, which is just some tensor product of Alice's message states, he's going to have to perform some POVM to turn this into his best guess of what Alice's message was. But before this technical hurdle was achieved in about 97 or so, the analogous formula was conjectured by Halevo, I mean, actually in the early 70s, to be the maximum of the mutual information between X and B over P of X. So I just want to clarify what this means. I mean, this looks like I've done nothing, right? But now this is a quantum state here. So I just want to explain what I mean. The idea is that this is now evaluated on some state of the following form. Sum over X, P of X, projector onto some orthogonal basis state X, corresponding to the classical part, tensor rho xb. So some people like to call this a CQ state or classical quantum state. And the idea is that if I wrote this out as a density matrix, it would be block diagonal, where the blocks are labeled by the classical part X. But inside the blocks, you have these density matrices here. And this is sort of a natural generalization of, let's say, a joint probability distribution where one guy's classical and the other one's quantum. And so I'm going to write this as rho xb. And just to clarify some notation, if I've defined a state like this, and then if I write rho b later, what I mean by that is it's the partial trace over x of rho xb. And the same will be true in general. If I have a state that is defined on five different quantum systems, maybe none of them are classical, and I remove some of the systems, I'll try to be clear when I do it, but I'll mean that it's a partial trace. And just to clarify, this here is just the sum over x of p of x rho sub xb. Okay? So this quantity here, I mean, writing it in this notation, it looks like a trivial extension of what's going on in Shannon's. But really what it is this is the entropy of this average state x, p of x, rho x, b, minus the average entropy h of rho bx. Okay? So, maybe one more notational thing that I want to point out that I'll use throughout the rest of this lecture. Group photo, 3 p.m. Is that I will write this h of b minus h of b given x. It's just a shorthand. But this means the same as this, means the same as this. And actually, the first way that this was ever written is something called the Holevo-Chi quantity, which maybe you might have heard of. And they would write that as chi of the ensemble of states p of x, rho xb. So the ensemble where state rho xb appears with probability p of x. So all these are synonymous, okay? But just to give you four different ways to write the same thing. So maybe I want to just mention a little bit more about entropy quantities. I want to tell you what was non-trivial about Holevo conjecturing that formula. Something called the Holevo bound. And in particular, when you're trying to prove the converse or the upper bound, right, you get to this point where you show that, well, any rate that's achievable, you know, has to be less than or equal to 1 over k. There's the mutual information between this xn sequence and the output message that you guess. Okay? So just to show how this is going to work again, you've got m into the nr. This goes to x1, xn. And let me just clarify that. Well, I'm going to assume that m is actually chosen uniformly random, right? So these are now random variables, okay? So in particular, assume I've got a good code where epsilon is going to 0. Then you can show that basically this is true, plus some epsilon. It goes to 0, actually, but it's a technical detail. Send these guys through this channel. I get b1 to bn. And then there's some measurement, which is basically by just some POVM. That then gives me my best guess. But is there a way to translate that back over to the quantum world? And, well, it would be if I could somehow show that this quantity here is less than or equal to I of xn vn. And then if you can do that, I claim that it's easy to go from there to show that this is less than or equal to the sum over I of I x I vi. Where these are evaluated on the marginals of this big joint quantum state here. And I also claim that this is entirely non-obvious how to go from here to there. And it's a non-trivial theorem that was proved in the 70s. It's known by the name Strong Subadditivity. So I want to say a little bit about that, just because it's a main technical tool in this sort of stuff. And I think that you should all see it. So the simplest way to describe this inequality is in terms of three quantum systems. So A, B, and C. And in terms of this Venn diagram, I'm going to look at the quantity that would correspond to this region right in here, right? So if I took the middle part here, that would be the mutual information between A and B. But this is somehow something that's conditioned on C. So actually, I'll call it this, I, A, B, given C. And we can define this as follows. This is H of AC plus H of BC minus H of C minus H of ABC. But really nobody thinks of this in terms of four entropies, but that's how you could write it out. And what the strong subadditivity inequality says is that this is greater than or equal to zero. So for the longest time, the only proofs known of this used operator monotone functions and some fairly heavy-duty complex analysis and that sort of stuff, monotone metrics. But now there's sort of other more operational proofs known, but I'm not going to get into that. But what I want to claim is that this quantity here, being positive, will let me show a theorem like this. So we'll call that the data processing inequality. And the idea is as follows. Let's say that I have I have some joint state on AB. And then now let's let a quantum channel enter. So this is a CPTP map. And we're going to let it take B to C. Okay, so this is a channel N. I always use like curly N for quantum channels. This takes me from system B to system C. So maybe just an aside. So I know you've all seen quantum channels already during this week, but many people say, oh, they act on the same system or something, but for me, quantum channels, and in general, you really should think of them as taking you from one system to another. So this is a map from, you know, it's a linear map from density matrices on system B to density matrices on system C. And if I write this out in Krauss form, the Krauss matrices are linear operators from B to C. Okay. So what I claim is that from this inequality, I can derive that the mutual information between A and B is greater than or equal to that between A and C. So intuitively, what I'm saying is that, you know, mutual information is a measure of like information content, or how much does system B have to say about A. And if I make B noisier by mapping it to some other system C, that should reduce the amount of information. And we can prove this in two easy steps. So I want to remind you of something called the Steinspring dilation or purification of a quantum channel. So let me just write this out. So this channel at N from A, or here it's going from B to C. It's a theorem that says that any such channel can be written as an isometry into some larger system. So let's call the isometry U from B to the tensor product of C in some environment E. Just another notational thing that I'm going to stick to in this talk is I always implicitly mean a tensor product when I write Hilbert spaces next to each other, but there should be no reason for confusion. It's just easier to read. So this is an isometry such that N acting on rho B equals the trace over E of U rho U dagger. Okay? So rho U dagger is some state rho on CE, and I just trace that over the E part. So this is called Steinspring dilation, or sometimes I'll just call it a purification. I might as well just tell you this. Maybe you've seen it already this week, but if I write out a Krauss form for this matrix, for this channel here, so n row equals sum over I, call that little e, n e row n e dagger. Right. So again, each of these guys is a map from B to C. You can kind of think of them as noise operators. Then one way to pick a Steinspring dilation is to just stack these matrices. Okay? So it's just an easy way to think about it is to say that U equals this. N1 through N. It's going to turn out to be the size of the environment. So just a couple things to notice is that the minimal size environment such that I can write a Steinspring dilation for a channel equals the minimum number of Krauss operators in any Krauss decomposition of the channel. And moreover, you know that Krauss decompositions are non-unique, right? So they're preserved not only by a unitary matrix that combines these guys, but actually by any isometry, anything that preserves lengths, right? So isometry is just a unitary that you throw out some of the rows, or you throw out some of the columns. And so it turns out that all Steinspring dilations are isometrically equivalent, or are related to one another by acting on the environment with some isometry. So I'll often talk about the Steinspring dilation, but really everything I'll say will apply to any such one for most purposes. So what we're going to do now is let's go back to this problem over here. We want to show this bound. Okay? Well, so let's take this channel here, and we'll Steinspring dilate it. We'll purify it. And then it becomes a isometry from B to CE. And then what I get is that this here equals I of A, BE. Where now I'm evaluating this here on the state that I get A, BE by taking this dilation right there, okay? And then I trace out over E. And the point is that this diagram commutes. So we're almost there. But it turns out that there's something called the chain rule for the mutual information, which I haven't told you about, but I encourage you to verify. It's pretty straightforward. And what it shows is that I can expand this, or I should say, sorry, this is CE. Okay, yeah. Because B went away. Is that this here equals IAC minus I A B given C. So that's not hard to show. And, well, I told you about this inequality here, that this is always greater than zero, so then that shows this bound. So we call that the data processing inequality. Or I should say that really only people who do information theory call this the data processing inequality, because in classical information theory, it's used all over the place, but you can actually show it using one line of freshman calculus, as opposed to needing to resort to more powerful machinery. But it's in some sense it's a quantum generalization of that that lets you then. I should say that once strong subadditivity was proved in the 70s, I think within a year or two, Halevo went ahead and conjectured this formula for the classical quantum capacity. So just to recap, why did I go through all this? Well, I wanted to tell you that I could turn this classical thing, I could back it up to a quantum system, which I then encourage you to verify that this follows. And then that gives you an analog. Yes? I think it's supposed to be a plus. Yeah. This was. Oh. Yeah, yeah, IA of E. Sorry, didn't see. And also, this is supposed to be a plus. Sorry. Right, so the idea is that this is a statement that holds on a state row A, C, D. Right, because the channel turned B into CE. So maybe I could have picked them better. But, yeah. And again, this is a plus in the chain rule. So the point to stress here, and maybe this is obvious, but maybe I should just mention it, is that measurement is a quantum channel. It's a quantum channel whose target is a space of commuting density matrices, right? So here, the classical outcome of the measurement, this is just some big, you know, 2 to the n r by 2 to the n r matrix of or diagonal matrix, right? That's going to give me the measurement probabilities associated with doing this decoding POVM here. And so in particular, I'm not going to tell you how you go about proving that such a thing exists. It's fairly technical, but maybe not overly complicated. If you're interested, I can point you in the literature to different places. But so at this point, I want to move. Well, I want to say a little bit about what happens in the case that we move away from the CQ channel paradigm. So here, kind of what I was said, at least to lead us up to this, we had this case where you have a classical input and it gives you some quantum state on the output. And I claim that you can actually get this nice single letter formula as an optimization over, or just one letter on, or over probability distributions on one letter at the input to the channel. I said this is exactly analogous to Shannon's case. So what happens if I want to send classical data over a fully quantum channel, so over something that's described by a completely positive trace-preserving map? So then you need to somehow make the input classical, right? So you need to prepare states on the input. And so for a long time, it was an open question of essentially whether or not entangled inputs could help. And if it had turned out that entangled inputs didn't help, then we would have an analogous formula. And maybe I don't want to get into the details. I can tell you later if you want to know. But the rough idea is that if the input is a so-called separable state, which is a convex combination of product states, then you can use some convexity argument to show that at least one of those product inputs would do just as well. But So Matt Hastings recently, you know, settled this additivity conjecture, which implied an answer to this, and he went into detail in this in his talk on, I think it was Monday, so I won't say too much more. Except I just want to stress that what Matt showed was that the analog of this fails, so that the formula is not additive. So in particular, it didn't say anything about the actual operationally defined capacity. And what we'll see for the quantum channels is that there's an analogous formula for which we have a reasonable capacity formula that works sometimes, and the analog of what Matt showed fails for those types of channels, or for other types of channels. But we also have this sort of non-operational additivity. So now I'll start talking about the quantum capacity. So the way to start off as always, is to give an operational definition of this quantity, and then we want to prove theorems about it. Can we somehow identify what it really is? So again, we do this by defining some sort of a code. So I'll define a code that has a rate of q, block length n, and error epsilon. I want to be vague about epsilon at first. To be something that approximately protects all states in a subspace of size 2 to the n q from n instances of a quantum channel. So the idea is that now I've got some code subspace C, and say I've got channel from A to B, right? So B comes out, and I have n instances of this noisy CPTP map. This. And in particular, what you can show is that it suffices to take this encoding map here to be an isometry. So in particular, it's an embedding of some code subspace C into the tensor product of n instances of the channel. So you can think of C as actually a subspace of the n-fold tensor power of the system A. And then the idea is that there should be some decoding map that takes me from the n outputs to sort of like another instance of the code subspace over here. And you want this to be such that this approximately looks like an identity channel from C here to C over there. So before I justify what I mean by approximately, I want to say a little more about the quantum capacity and what we know about it, and also give some examples. So the best answer that we know involves a quantity that is analogous to the mutual information, and it's known by the name coherent information. And there's a couple different ways of defining it. So let me just give some more space here. So coherent information, I want to just... bit about. So given some density matrix on the input to the channel relay, I'll define this function, or say it's a function of the density matrix, and the channel equal the entropy of the output minus the entropy in the environment of the channel. So I think this deserves a little clarification. So given the channel, I can pick some Stein-Sprung dilation, some purification, right? It's not unique, but I claim I pick any one, and that this formula is consistent. And why is that? Well, it's because any two Stein-Sprung dilations are related by an isometry on the environment. And I claim that if I take a density operator and I act on it with a unitary or an isometry, I'm not going to change the spectrum. So if you don't change the spectrum, you're definitely not going to change the entropy. So this is actually well defined, even though I may not have a definite map like this in mind. But it's an important thing to realize, is that somehow when I talk about a noisy quantum process, I can still somehow characterize the amount of information or entropy that leaks into the environment, even if I don't exactly know what the environment is. But as long as I have some reasonable model that I feel confident about describing whatever noise is happening to the input quantum system, this kind of a thing makes sense. So let me just tell you some other interesting ways of writing this. So let's say that I take this state row and I purify it into a copy of itself. So what's a purification? Well, this is just some state. So let's say that row is given by this form. It's sum over A, P of A probabilities, on some orthonormal basis, like this. So these A's, these ket A's are the eigenvectors, and the P A's are the eigenvalues. So the P A's are just probabilities. Okay? Then this would be something of this following form, with a Schmidt decomposition like this. And it's an easy exercise to see that if I take this, I form a projector out of it, and I trace out, say, the first copy, that I get back this state here. So if I do that, I then get this state, row AA. And let's draw it like this. So I have this A up here and A down here. And then I act with the channel. And I go through and I get a state on B. I get some density matrix here, row AB. So in that case, I claim that this coherent information can also be written as minus H of A given B. So why is that? Well, if instead of the channel, if I had its purification, then I add on another terminal here with the environment of the channel. Okay? So then minus H of A given B equals minus H of AB plus H of B. But what you can show, so this whole state here is pure, right? So I start off with a purification here, and I act on it with an isometry over there, so there's nothing causing any noise, right? You're not throwing anything away. Then I've got some pure state on ABE. But what you can show, and it's not hard to show, again, and I encourage you to check this if you don't believe me, that if I have a pure state, and I look at the entropy on some subset of the systems, that's the same as the entropy on the other subset of the systems. So this here is the same as minus H of E. And that's another way to see how to write this formula. Oh, sorry. Is this better? So in other words, this is H of B minus H of E, which is this quantity here. So I'm just showing you that there's another way to write this. So I want to tell you now the formula, the best known formula that we have. Yes? Right. So let me just give the formula next, and that may, this is, what I'm going to tell you is sort of the meaning. So so the quantum capacity of a channel, we know that a good lower bound on it is the following, is the maximum of the coherent information. So the coherent information is somewhat analogous to the mutual information, but now for quantum capacity. So for rho A, the coherent information So I say less than or equal to here because this bound is known not to be tight in general. So in some sense, it doesn't have the same status as the mutual information as being the complete solution of the problem. It only solves it for certain classes of channels, and I'll tell you about those. In general, so So if I define this as, I'll call this Q1N, then the general formula that we have is again one of these terrible expressions. It's the limit as k goes to infinity, whatever k, Q1, like this. And in the spirit of what I showed you before with the, this shouldn't be, in the classical capacity, I might call this quantity here QKN. And I'll try to get across that you sort of have the same problem where you're designing codes such that the inputs look like a tensor power of some state on many copies of the channel. And I think this is one of the biggest open questions right now in quantum information is to determine if you can give some expression that doesn't need a limit for either for a general channel or even for certain classes of channels, and even for a particular very simple channel, which I'll tell you about in a little bit. So, but rather than depressing you about how we don't know what to do, I'll tell you about a class of channels where we can reduce this down to a single expression. But maybe one more comment I'd like to make, which is, so this coherent information is defined as a difference of entropies, right? So first of all, I want you to notice that it can go negative for arbitrary states, but somehow this maximization is always non-negative. It might be zero when you maximize, but the maximization is never negative. And you can view these two entropies as, in some sense, this here is measuring how much information leaks out into the environment, and this is measuring how much information is in the output. And the idea is that when you do good codes, at least codes that are designed to achieve this quantity, that the entropy in the output winds up coming from two places. It comes from the input, and it comes from part of the output being correlated with the environment, sort of as a shield for the noise in the environment. But when is there a single letter? So a single letter formula. Well, one large class is a class of degradable, so-called degradable channels. So I'll say that a channel from A to B is degradable when, if I look at its purification into an environment, its Stein-Sprung dilation, when there exists a third channel to the environment, I'll call it a degrading channel, that makes this diagram commute. So by that, what I mean is that there should exist a D from B to E such that DN on any input state equals what I'll call the complement channel acting on that state. So by that I mean I'm given a channel, I write down the Stein-Sprung dilation of it, that's into two systems, so you recover the usual channel by tracing out over E, right, the environment. But what if instead you decided to trace out over the output? Well, that gives you sort of a non-canonical channel into an environment. But again, all such of these complementary channels are related by some isometry on the environment. So it's kind of an, you can think of it as an equivalence class of channels. You can just pick any one. And this definition still winds up being consistent in that way. So this is all sort of abstract, but I'd like to make it concrete by giving you some examples of channels that fit into this class. But let me just say in words, at least, that the intuitive reason why these channels are a little nicer is that kind of everything about the noise can be obtained by looking at the environment. So one example is what I'll call the quantum erasure channel. So this is a channel from, let's say CD to CD plus 1. So there's one extra, really from matrices on this to that. Here's A and that's B. So there's one extra state on B. And we'll call that's the erasure state. And the idea is that this is a channel where you put in a state, and with probability 1 minus P, the receiver gets it, and the receiver knows that they got it. And with probability P, the state gets erased or lost, and there's some indication by the receiver that they lost the state. So we'll call this channel that works like this. Rho equals 1 minus P thing on rho plus P times some other orthogonal state. So this E is orthogonal to all the degrees of freedom in rho. So let me just give you an exercise, which is to, write down a Steinspring dilation of this channel, and B, which is more important, show that it's complement, and P complement of rho is just the same thing with one minus P probability of error. So the idea is that when the actual channel gets the state, the environment sees an erasure, and vice versa. So this is a nice thing to check if you're interested in this sort of thing. I should write erasure channel. So, let's see. Another example would be, in some sense, almost a direct analog of this channel, this binary symmetric channel. So I'll call it the P bit flip or qubit flip channel. And the idea there is that state rho gets mapped to itself. So let's just say it's a qubit, right? It's a map on qubits, rho. Plus, with probability P, it's going to map to itself flipped by the sigma x operator. So sigma x is just 1, or 0, 1, 1, 0. Take 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. So clearly, if you take this channel and you put in the 0, 1 computational basis states, it looks just like the binary symmetric channel. But it turns out that the quantum capacity of the qubit flip that this is also 1 minus the binary entropy of P. But don't confuse us with thinking that, well, that's the same formula we had here for classical. I mean, it's the same formula, but for entirely different reasons. And the quantum capacity of the erasure channel actually winds up being 1 minus 2p. Or I should say it's really the max of that and zero. So in particular, when your erasure probability is greater than a half, it turns out that the quantum capacity is zero, and it's easy to see why there's an upper bound on this by using a no-cloning argument. And that comes down to this fact here, or the thing that underlies this fact, which is to say when when my state gets erased by Unitarian, it has to go somewhere, so it went to the environment. So if over half my states are getting erased that I put through, if I could recover those, well, the environment has a stronger signal. So the environment should be able to recover them too, and that would lead to, you know, an impossibility, which is that of cloning information. So that's how you can see that this here has to be zero when p is greater than a half. And to see the other way, well, I'll leave these as exercises, if you're interested, to try to compute them from this formula here. So just to clarify, for these channels, q of n equals q1n, which is just the maximum over rho of the coherent information. Okay. Well, I think of, oh, is there more white spots?
Yeah.
No. So I have to switch. So what about a non-example? Oh, I can just push this up. So I want to show you a very simple channel, which is in some sense another type of generalization of this channel here. And we have no idea what its capacity is. And actually, we know embarrassingly little about its capacity, despite its practical relevance. And that's the P depolarizing channel. So this channel, takes state rho to 1 minus P rho, plus P times the maximally mixed state. So the completely random state on a qubit. So again, it's a qubit channel. So this channel, despite its similarity to these guys, we have no clue. So maybe I'm going to show you also a picture that you can, for qubit channels, you can envision them how they act on the block sphere. Right, so this qubit flip channel here is something that takes the whole block sphere and it maps it like this. So it takes it down to some squashed version of the block sphere. But notice in particular that these states here wind up staying the same, right? Because flipping a 0 and a 1 will take the state 0 plus 1 to itself, and 0 minus 1 goes to minus itself, but you mod out by phases. So on the other hand, this channel here, what it does is it shrinks the block sphere. So they're very similar types of behaviors. But I should say that in a lot of analyses of fault tolerance, this is the type of channel that people like to think about. It's kind of the worst case type of errors that you could imagine happening. And it also turns out that this channel is not degradable. And that's essentially why we don't know its capacity. And I'll also sort of say that really the only channels for which we know the capacity are essentially degradable channels. There's other channels that have zero capacity, and they may have capacity at zero for a different reason than having to do with degradability. It's not just related. But apart from certain zero capacity channels and certain channels that we know how to bound it to show that it's kind of close to zero, these are the only channels that for which we can actually really identify the capacity.
Do you know when this one's zero?
We don't even know when it's zero. We have such a bad idea of when it's zero, it's embarrassing. So here's what we know. We know that Q of NP is greater than, so let's let P star equal the maximum P that this is 0. We know that P star is somewhere in between 1/4 and 1/3. So there's an upper bound that kind of comes from essentially a no cloning type of argument. And this lower bound is, I don't know, something like 0.2523, or, I mean, people get really excited if you change this to 0.25 and you get a PRL out of that. I mean, it's really so little is known. And the way people do it is, well, they try to evaluate something of this form, 1 over K, I of rho acting on, say, you know, K systems of this. And they try to maximize the P such that this crosses 0. And, I mean, I invite you to play with this for K equals 1, just for one instance, because there it turns out that this guy here is maximized for a maximally mixed input. And actually, I wanted to just kind of give this as sort of an exercise. So show that you have the Krauss form square root of 1 minus 3p over 4 times the identity matrix, and then square root of p over 4 times the matrices x, y, and z, the Pauli matrices. So there's 4 different Krauss operators. That's one thing that makes this channel hard, because you need the environment to be as big as it can be in order to support this channel. And so from this, I claim that once you compute these, if you manage to show that this is optimized, at least for a certain range of P, well, you can play with it, but you'll see that there's a certain range of P where it's obviously greater than 0, and then for those, this is maximized by a maximally mixed state on one input. So this is just for K equals 1. And then from this, you can get an expression for where this guy crosses 0 as a function of P, and it's already right around this 0.25 mark. And then people, like I said, people get really excited when they figure out a way to stick in some state here that is on 25 copies of the channel and use some clever techniques to try to push this bound up ever so slightly. Yet, you know, we have this really wide range here. And maybe one other exercise I kind of want to give if you're interested in thinking about this channel. So it turns out that this channel is covariant under SU2 rotations. So if I take some unitary U in SU2, U dagger, that this is the same thing as U N rho U dagger. Okay, this is not too hard to show. But what I found kind of interesting is that if you look at the environment channel, well, the environment is also covariant, but so here you have the defining representation of SU2 on the input. And then on the output, you get actually the spin 0 plus the spin 1 acting on the environment. So if you're into representation theory and stuff, you might want to play with that. And I've kind of had some ideas that maybe if you know what sheer duality and stuff is, that maybe that might lead to some techniques for maybe pushing this bound up. But it the problem gets hard fast. So just to entice people who might be interested in thinking about this sort of thing. So let me give one more example of a class of degradable channels, which also is going to come with another exercise. Oh, leave that up there. So another class is what people have called generalized dephasing channels. So I'll just claim that these are channels that, you know, map you from, say, CD to CD, you know, between two D-dimensional systems. And they have a dilation that looks like this. So basis state I on A gets mapped to basis state I on B. Tensor some other state I on the environment. So the idea is that these guys here they don't have to be orthogonal, but these two are bases or orthonormal bases. So I claim, and I invite you to check the following, that if you write the Krauss form out, that these have commuting Krauss operators. And I also invite you to check that if you look at their action on density matrices, that it's diagonal in the IJ basis. So this goes to some lambda IJ, IJ. And for example, this commuting Krauss operator thing is one way to see that the qubit flip channel falls into this class. I'm going to show that. So I've told you all this stuff about the quantum capacity, but I sort of waved my hands a bit about how to make sense out of the idea of approximate error correction. So I want to say a bit about that at this point. So, given some channel from a code subspace to itself, and you should really think of this as being something of the form code subspace, some encoding map into, you know, some other channel. So this would go to some system A, then there's some channel, this goes to system B. Then there's some decoding, and then I go back to my code subspace. For now, I just want to focus on this case here. And actually, I'll technically have a tensor N there. But let's just focus on the end result first. So you want to know how to compare. So let's say I have some state, just say some pure state, on the inputs of the channel. How do I compare this to this? So let me just mention one more convention that I'll make, is that if I've defined a pure state inside of a ket and I write it without the ket, that's the shorthand for this. Just because eventually, I'm going to start writing formulas that are going to look way too long if I have this in there every time it's a projection. So how can I compare these guys? I want to say that they're epsilon close. So I claim that there's two different operational ways of doing this, meaning that they involve making some sort of a measurement. And in the sense that when they're exactly the same, the measurement always succeeds in doing the task. And yet each one has a different mathematical meaning. So the first way would be to perform some POVM on this output here, the state that I get by acting with this channel, and just see if it looks like the same state I started with. So in particular, I'm just going to take this two-outcome POVM. So it just measures, are you this state? So this is a projector, right? Or are you in the orthogonal subspace to that state? And so if I do this, then the probability of success is just going to be the trace of this POVM element, which is the state, right, with the channel. Not row, it's phi. Okay? But if I expand this out again, so this here is this, so by cyclicity of the trace, this is none other than this. Okay, it's a matrix element of this density matrix here. So even though I started with a pure state, it became mixed. Imagine I wrote this in a basis such that this was like the first basis element, it would just be like the upper left-hand corner matrix element. And so this quantity here, people call this the fidelity between this pure state and this mixed state. So it's actually a slightly more general type of fidelity, which I'll get to in a minute, but this is what it reduces to when one of the states is pure. And it has this operational meaning. So the second way might be to not check to see is it the state or is it something else, but to say how well can I possibly distinguish between the two states by doing some measurement. So there's something called a Hellstrom measurement, which is basically what you get if I tell you that there's two states A and B, and they each occur with equal probability, and you want to do some measurement that maximizes your probability of distinguishing between A or B, you know, averaged over the different states that can be there. And I don't want to get into the details, but I'll just say it's with a uniform prior. But the answer is going to be that this probability that you distinguish them correctly is, let's say twice the probability is just the trace norm between the two states. So the trace norm, this is just the L1 norm on operators. And given any operator, all it is just the sum of the singular values of the operator. Okay, so this generates a pretty nice topology on states that it turns out is going to be closely related to this one. So I'll just say this is sum of singular values of the difference. Okay? And each one kind of has its place in analyzing things approximately. So what I also want to add is that we actually, this fidelity, it applies to mixed states too, pairs of mixed states. And I'll define the fidelity of two mixed states, say rho and sigma, as the trace norm of square root of rho times square root of sigma. So this is a compact way of writing it that you may have seen this written in more complicated ways. Most people don't write it like this for some reason, but you could also write it as the square of the trace of the square root of the square root of rho sigma square root. So this ugly expression like this, and it's not apparently symmetric in rho and sigma, but you can show it is, and you might want to check that if you don't believe me. So I'll say that this fidelity here, it's not a metric on states, right? So this fidelity is something that if the states are close, it's going to be 1. If the states are the same, it's going to be 1. Whereas trace distance, if the states are close, it's going to be close to 0. But this is related to the Boras metric. If you've heard of this thing, or if you're wondering, just to overload you with information, I'll tell you that the Boras metric is the square root of twice 1 minus square root of fidelity. If you don't know what that is, don't worry. So one nice thing about trace distance and fidelity is that they're monotonic under CP maps in the following sense. What's the difference between this one and this one?
Well, why do you call both
Well, this is fidelity, and this is a special case of fidelity, where one of them is a pure state. But I was just leading up to it. So we have the following, that if I take rho sigma and I look at their trace distance, and then let's say that I then act on both of them with a channel. That can't make them any more distinguishable. Okay? So they're going to move closer together. And you have this lower bound. We call this monotonicity of trace distance on your CPTP maps. And again, I invite you to check this also, but you could easily look it up. And on the other hand, you have a similar formula for the fidelity. But now it goes the other way, because this is a 1 minus error type of thing. F of And maybe one last thing, just to give you everything you ever need to know about this stuff, so you have it in one place. You have these bounds. The fidelity is greater than or equal to 1 minus the trace distance. And the trace distance is less than or equal to twice the square root of 1 minus the fidelity. I should warn you that some authors don't use the squared version of the fidelity. Some people just use the square root. So be careful if you are trying to apply these in general. But so one last fact I want to tell you about the fidelity, which I guess I can't really fit on this slide. Is something called Ullmann's theorem. So what this says is that the fidelity between two states, rho and sigma, is equal to the maximum over purifications ket rho, ket sigma. And again, purifications, this just means that you add in another Hilbert space such that if I trace out over that Hilbert space on this pure state, I get back the mixed state of this. Of just the squared overlap between the states. And even what's further is that this is just the same thing, the maximum over, say, purifications on one system, given that I've maybe fixed the purification of the other. And again, this is fairly straightforward linear algebra. I think it's even on the Wikipedia if you really want to know how to prove it. But it's a good exercise to go through. So I sort of promised you that I was going to justify, in some sense at least, what we mean by approximately correcting quantum errors over a quantum channel. So now I'm going to kind of wave my hands a little bit because we're getting close to lunch. But what I want to get across is the following, that rather than trying to send states on a Hilbert space, it makes more sense to try to send part of an entangled state that's entangled with the subspace. Partly because it's more mathematically cleaner, more mathematically clean, and also partly because it has a relation to, say, studying the average fidelity, say, over all pure states on the subspace. And using arguments similar to what I kind of mentioned at the beginning of these lectures about this lecture about maximal versus average error, that the same thing holds. Is that if I have a code that does well in an average sense, then what I can show is that I can restrict down to a smaller subspace that's not much smaller. And I have a code that pretty much has good maximal performance as well. So in particular, what we can imagine now is that I have this channel N, C to C, and what I want to do is I want to then think of it by putting on another, say, identity channel from C to C in front. So now there's kind of two C systems. And I want to see how well that preserves some state that's potentially entangled between two copies of C. And then the idea is that the channel acts on the right C, and then this identity channel kind of stays behind. And then, so you've got this state here. And I want to compare this with this pure state here. So again, if you want to know more about this justification, I can tell you after the fact, but I don't want to get into it right now. And so in general, if I go back to the setting where the channel is acting many times, I can imagine then the code is going to be some state like this that's now entangled with some subspace of the inputs of the channels, right? So here I can think of C as living inside of A tensored N times. And I can sort of identify this state with the state on C, AN. That corresponds to the embedding. But I'm actually going to be simpler than that, right? So what I want to think about is something, I want to talk about something, I'll call it just entanglement generation. And I claim that essentially the weakest type of thing that you might hope to do with a quantum channel is, at least at the level of achievable rates in the definition of the quantum capacity, equivalent to, and like the strongest possible thing, like protecting all possible states from errors. And that's something called entanglement generation. And the idea is that you just want to create some state. I'll always use a capital phi for a maximally entangled state. So this is just some state of a form, normalized by the square root of the dimension C, I, C, C. So this state kind of represents the strongest type of correlation you can have between two systems of the same size. And in particular, what I'll do is in thinking of a 2 to the, of a rate Q block length N code, the idea is that I'll take the size of C to be 2 to the N Q. Right? So in particular, what this will look like, at least for the, for good values of Q, is it'll look like a Bell state, 1 over root 2, 0, 0, plus 1, 1, tensored NQ times. So in some sense, this is like NQ units of maximal quantum correlation. And we want to try to generate this by using a channel many times. So what I want to get across in the last part of this is to convince you that in order to create a state that is maximally entangled or close to maximally entangled, it's enough to try to ensure that if I take half of this state, put it through the channel, that the stuff that's left over here on the left shouldn't get correlated with the environment. So by that I mean this. So let's say that I have C and C. Here's my entangled state. And I output this on, well, there's the channel, but I want to now consider the purification in this picture. So here's B, here's E. And technically, I should have N's on all these because I'm thinking of using the channel many times, but we don't really need to think about that at this point. So then I get some state on this trio of systems. It's a pure state on this triple of systems, okay? And what I claim is that if I can ensure that the restriction to C and E, if this is exactly a product state, then I can decode with certainty. I basically have a zero error scenario where I can exactly get this state. But that if I do it approximately, that I get an approximate recovering of it in the sense of any of these, you know, trace distance or fidelity, because they're closely related. And again, the end result is you want these things to be small, so they're sort of interchangeable. So let's assume that F, so let me call this state here, I don't know, ket. Well, I'll call it this, CBE. So it's just what you get by acting on this half of it, of this state here. And let's assume that the fidelity between the state on CE and the same thing that I get if I take the traced out version on C, which incidentally is just going to be like maximally random because the partial trace of half of this guy is just a maximally mixed state, and the corresponding state on E. Assume that that's small, that's less than epsilon. So what I want to show you is that basically by a line of reasoning that involves this Ullmann theorem characterization of the fidelity, as well as the fact that any two purifications of a state are equivalent up to isometries on the purifying system, that proves that there exists a decoder that decodes this with the same fidelity. So let's first pretend that this equals zero. Okay? So if this equals zero, then this state equals that state. Okay? Then I have exact decoupling. So what I claim is that let me look at the fidelity, or let me look at a purification of this guy. Well, first of all, we know that this guy purifies into B, right? Because, I mean, I'm just talking about the reduced state on C and E. And if this is already a product state, well, then I can just go back to the original state here. And that's a purification. So, phi on CBE is a purification of this state there. But there's another way I can write a purification, because this is a tensor product state, right? So I purify them individually. And what I get is I can purify this guy by the original state that I wanted to send. This one here. And then I purify this other guy by some state. Well, I'm going to write it with a different character because it's not going to be maximally entangled. On some E. Okay? But because all purifications are related by an isometry, that means that there has to exist some isometry here, some W from B to both, you know, to this copy of C here and to this second copy of E there. Okay? Such that if I act on this state here, or I should say, if I act on this state that I got here, then it gives me this state. So now clearly, if I trace out over E, what have I got left here? I've just got the second copy of C, and it's pretty easy to see that I got this state exactly. So to go back to the paradigm of exact error correction, well, A, we are in exact error correction here, but in what you've heard earlier about it, is that you make some syndrome measurement, right? And then based on that syndrome measurement, you do some unitary in order to repair the state. So technically, that's all hiding underneath the, that's all going on behind the scenes here, right? Because disregarding E is sort of the same thing as doing a measurement to it. in some basis and then forgetting the measurement. And kind of forgetting that measurement is also equivalent to doing the repair unitaries. So that's in this exact case, but I claim that in the approximate case where this is greater than or equal to epsilon, that it's basically the same thing going on, right? Where we can, you know, fully apply Ullmann's theorem now. And that's to say that if this fidelity is small, I take this purifying state of the target state. So again, this guy is close to this ideal state. This is really the one that physically happens. So that means that there's some purification of this that's close to this state. And it's going to have the same purifying map right here. Or not purifying, I should say. They're related by the same isometry from B to CE. So just to sort of write it all out, what I would get then is that the fidelity between, you know, the state that I wind up decoding and the state that I'd ultimately like to have, well, this is going to be upper bounded by the fidelity that I get before I do this partial trace, right? So the fidelity of this state on C, E, C, E, and the ideal state tensor this other weird state there. But if I trace out both the E systems, let me pull that like a hat there, then, So technically this is supposed to be greater than or equal to 1 minus epsilon, right? And then this guy here, I'm reversing all these. Oh no. So this fidelity is greater than that fidelity, which is greater than this. And so that's how you get this approximate thing. So I'm pretty much out of time, so I just want to say in the last 2 or 3 minutes, how do you actually prove this theorem? So it's quite technical. I didn't want to get into the details. But I'll say that, so I said earlier that for these coding theorems in the classical case, what you do is you pick a random code book, right? You kind of choose your code words at random, and you can show using some analysis that you get a good code on average. And you average over the choice of random code book, and then that proves that there must exist a good code. Well, so the same thing happens here, except now instead of picking a random set of messages, what I do is I pick a random subspace of some subset of the input, right? So again, for the classical capacity, what you did was you fixed some probability distribution P of X that comes up in the formula you maximize the mutual information, you get some probability distribution that achieves that maximum, then you pick code words according to that distribution. So now what you do is you pick a density matrix that maximizes this coherent information. And then you want to kind of pick a random subspace in such a way that when you average over the subspaces that it looks like that tensor product state. So one way of phrasing that is, I mentioned at the very beginning this task of data compression, right, where I have sequences of random variables, xn, that are iid according to some p of x. Well, the analog of this is just some tensor power density matrix, rho tensor n. And what you can show in direct analogy to what I said happens in the classical case, where there's some subset of sequences that's of size roughly 2 to the n h, well, there's actually some subspace of basis vectors on which, you know, if I write the projector onto that subspace, that this trace is large. It can be like greater than 1 minus epsilon for some small epsilon. And that the size of this subspace is also going to be 2 to the nh. So, So I'll just say that what you need to do is you need to pick a subspace of this space here, because it turns out that this is going to be 2 to the n h of A. And you have that you can show that h of B minus h of E, which is the coherent information, that this is less than or equal to h of A. So you just pick a subspace of size, sorry that I'm like writing all over, I've written already, of size 2 to the n coherent information randomly from according to, say, the Haar measure over all subspaces in that space. And it can be shown that leads to a good code. And kind of the reason I talked about all this decoupling is because that's actually what you focus on in the simplest type of a proof. So maybe I'll close by saying that in this decoupling, notice that these expressions, they don't involve a decoder, right? They derive a decoder from this Ullmann's theorem characterization of the fidelity. So that's something that simplifies the matters a lot. So this proof that I've kind of been outlining is by myself, Mikhail Horodetsky, Patrick Hayden, and Andreas Winter, and it appears in, there's a special issue of the journal Open Systems and Information Dynamics that came out last year, and it's actually completely devoted to the quantum capacity. So there's about 5 or 6 different proofs in there. The first fully rigorous proof was due to Devitak in like 03, but it's very, very technical, and ours simplified things in a major way. But I'll say don't read the version on the archive because it's not up to date. And I think that's all I want to say, so thanks.